And joining us on the book club on Perspectives today is New York Times bestselling author Maria Gudovich. She is the author of the book Dr. Dogs, How Our Best Friends Are Becoming Our Best Medicine. Maria, thank you so much for being with us here today.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Now, before we get started, I want to tell our listening audience a little bit more about Maria. Maria is a former USA Today journalist. I already said she's a New York Times bestselling author, but she has written three other books called Soldier Dogs, Top Dog, and Secret Service Dogs. She lives in San Francisco with, among others, her yellow Labrador retriever, Gus, and Gus's sister comes to visit once in a while. So thank you. Tell us a little bit about, first of all, about yourself. Have you always been interested in pets, dogs, since you were a little girl?
Yeah, well, when I was eight, we moved to rural Maine, and we hadn't had any pets until then, but then it was one dog after the other. We would take in various dogs, and I wanted to be a veterinarian at one point. I think so many people in their teens do, but then I went to a veterinary practice for 3 days to see what that would be like, and I watched them doing surgery, and I fainted, and so I decided to change my path, and my second choice was journalism, and my ideal world is what I have now, is writing about dogs and other animals, but mostly dogs. So, and I even managed to work it into my USA Today career. Every so often I would write about animals, and this is my happy point. So my last now four books have been about dogs and working dogs in particular and what they do, and it's incredible. I had no idea, and after my first book, I had learned so much. I looked at my own dog with vastly more respect than ever.
Have you ever considered or have you thought about writing a short story or a novel about dogs? Because as we all know, there are a lot of good books out there about dogs that we read perhaps as children. Old Yeller was the one that stands out, of course, and it's very sad. There is The Incredible Journey and some other dog books and cat books out there. And I think a children's book, I had one that I used to read to my oldest daughter when she was a baby, and she just loved that puppy dog.
Oh, yeah. I would love to be able to write fiction. I greatly respect the people who do, and I think it's just such a different genre and such a different art. I love reading those books, and there's one book in particular called Beautiful Joe. It was written in the 1920s, I think, or even before that, and I have a very old edition of that, and it was about this dog who was badly abused. His ears were cut off by his cruel owner, and he came into this wonderful family, and about his adventures after that. So, yes, maybe one day when I cool down from all the nonfiction, but I think that's a very separate genre.
When you decided to take on the task of writing your first dog book, how did that idea come about, and how was it received by your publicist agent?
Well, actually, my first dog books were while I was writing for USA Today. I had written an article for the San Francisco Chronicle about places to take a dog in the Bay Area. I was freelancing for them at the time, and I had just gotten a dog, and there were not that many places, so that became a book. I wrote a book called The Bay Area Dog Lover's Companion, and that became The California Dog Lover's Companion, which is 1,000 pages, and eventually I had a human child in 1996, and I started doing more freelance dog writing, and I was an editor at Dogster. And so what happened was in 2011, the Osama bin Laden raid happened, and the world learned that, yes, there are military dogs out there, and because there was a military working dog with Navy SEAL Team 6, and when they raided the compound, and I had grown up with a dad who was a very young soldier in World War II, and he was telling my brother and me frequently about what was going on and how the dogs who were with them would save people physically by day and then save souls at night. And I had thought maybe that would be a really good article or a really good book, and I was writing articles. So I actually got a call from an agent who said, would you be interested in writing a book about military dogs? And I said, well, funny you ask. So I was in a really good place to start that, and that's kind of how that came about.
Did you have to go to a special school or anything like that to write the book on soldier dogs? Because I imagine they have to go through some extensive training.
Yeah, I went to Lackland Air Force Base, which is ground zero where all those dogs get trained. All the military dogs are trained there, the ones who go after the bad guys, the ones who sniff out bombs or narcotics as well. And I was mostly going for the ones who go to war, so the ones who track people and also the ones who sniff out IEDs before they have a chance to hurt people. And I had a very, very short deadline for that book. It was worse than any other deadline I've ever had, and I didn't get a chance to go to Afghanistan, and I had to actually debate if I had had a chance to do that, would I have gone, because I value my life, and as much as I so admire these guys, it was a pretty rough time at the time. That was in 2011. And so I went around the country, and I went to Yuma, Arizona, where they go to pre-deployment training, and they set it up so it looks as if they have sort of a generic Middle East village, but they have mosques, they have roads, they have everything, and the weather. It was about 120 degrees one day while I was there. So I was watching the training intensely and getting to know a lot of the men and women who were going over and their dogs.
We're visiting with New York Times bestselling author Maria Goodavage, and her latest book is called Dr. Dogs, How Our Best Friends Are Becoming Our Best Medicine. We've been discussing one of her other books, Soldier Dogs, and as we carry on through that, we've read stories, articles, TV news stories, that these dogs are very dear to the handlers in the military, and also sometimes a whole unit embraces that dog as one of their own.
Yeah, absolutely. The dogs and the handlers bond because they're with them when they deploy. They're with them almost 24/7. When they're not deployed, the dogs sleep in the kennels, and the handlers see them for training, and they start bonding immediately because they have to. Without that bond, as anyone who has a dog knows, that bond is so deep and so meaningful and so life-saving in many ways. And the dogs and handlers work together here in the U.S. or wherever they're training, and they build that bond, and they work on that. And then over in war zones, they're together, they're helping the unit. Sometimes these dogs seem to know who in the unit needs the most help, who, like my dad, who is homesick, who's having a bad day, whose girlfriend or boyfriend just broke up with them from afar, and go to those. And dog is just, it's a part of normal life. They bring a little bit of normalcy to these hellish situations. So they're a really important part of life there, and beyond their function of walking point and taking these people through these deadly fields of where mines and IEDs are. And they do such a great job. And in the book that came after Soldier Dogs called Top Dog, I really focused on one dog named Luca who went on more than 400 missions and got everyone through them safely. And these are really dangerous missions. She was incredible. She could sniff out IEDs. She was so bonded with her handler, and they worked together. She was an off-leash detection dog, so she could go far afield, and her handler could use hand signals, or sometimes she would have little sort of walkie-talkie device, and he would whisper to her left, right, and she would be able to sniff out IEDs that way. And that's a story that is very near and dear to my heart.
Maria Goodavage, she's talked a little bit about soldier dogs and top dogs, and now let's move on to Secret Service dogs. And as we all know, the Secret Service has played an important role in taking care of presidents and the presidential family, first family. Of course, they were around during Abraham Lincoln's time, but they were part of the U.S. Treasury and handled counterfeit instead of what they do now. How long have dogs been helping the Secret Service?
It's been since the 1970s, so it hasn't been all that long, actually. And the Secret Service still does work in counterfeiting, and there is actually a dog trained at one point to help detect counterfeit currency, believe it or not. That's no longer something a dog is doing, but it became evident that there was the Secret Service learned by watching regular law enforcement that dogs can bring so much to the effort to keep someone safe. So they started bringing in dogs. At first, the program wasn't a great success because there was a big learning curve, and they got these big badass dogs who were maybe a little out of control, but they learned they needed highly sociable dogs because these dogs are going to be going out into the public. They're in front of the White House. These dogs interact with people all the time. So the dogs became a quick. Program quickly got under control and was immensely successful and has been since. There are dogs stationed behind the White House fence, and those dogs are the emergency response team. They're the ones who can and have gone after people who have tried to infiltrate the White House. They can stop them. The goal is to apprehend someone before they get in. It hasn't always happened because dogs are not always right there on the spot, but they're really, really, really good at their jobs. I've watched them training, and they're incredible. And there are also the dogs who are stationed at the White House for where visitors come in. If you've ever visited the White House, you probably didn't even know it, but you were sniffed by dogs. There's a dog who is stationed behind a screen, and you walk into this one room, and you put your feet on these little footprints and stand there, and you might have this idea, like, why am I standing here with my feet on these footprints? And then you move into the next room. There's a dog behind a screen who is sniffing, and if you have an explosive on you or any, maybe even fertilizer, the dog will sit, and then you are pulled away and questioned. And dogs are also stationed outside the White House, and everywhere the president and vice president go, there will be dogs. And this has been the case for every president since this started. And also presidential candidates get some protection by dogs. So they're pretty busy these days.
There are probably some of our listeners may be wondering, I know I'm wondering, what about the dogs themselves? Does it matter whether they're male, female, or a particular species that are best for a certain job?
In the case of White House dogs, there are a great mix. And actually, even in war dogs, they're a great mix. They tend not to neuter the males, so the males are unneutered, and the females tend to be spayed because they don't want them having babies. So that seems to work. But either one, and for the dogs who go after, let's just the apprehension dogs, let's say, those tend to be a breed called Belgian Malinois. They're kind of like, and also German Shepherds, but it's really going toward Belgian Malinois. They're kind of like a lean and lithe version of a German Shepherd, and they're lighter so that they can be carried over fences, and they don't have such hip problems as German Shepherds. And they are very, very energetic, and they really, really want to work. So they're bred for this. They're bred in Europe, and the Secret Service has someone procuring them for what they do. And the same often with the military dogs. They often come from various European countries who excel in police dog sports. And there are some dogs who work for the Secret Service who are definitely not that way. They're the ones who are in front of the White House, oftentimes, who are called the floppy ear dogs. They're called friendly dogs, and they have to go through the crowds, and they do something. They track anything. If they smell something with explosives, they want to get to somebody before they have a chance to get to the White House. So these affable-looking dogs, they're Springer Spaniels, Labrador Retrievers, anything who looks pretty friendly, and they're just out there in the public. If they had a Belgian Malinois or a German Shepherd doing this, they would part the crowds. There are people from all over the world here. They would probably make people scatter sometimes, but these dogs are just little dogs and hanging out, big dogs hanging out, looking friendly, and they're really good at tracking. They're called vapor detection dogs, vapor tracing dogs, and they trace the vapors of these explosives, so hopefully they would stop anything before it had a chance to get too close.
We're visiting with New York Times bestselling author Maria Gudevich, and she is the author of the book Dr. Dogs, How Our Best Friends Are Becoming Our Best Medicine. It's become a little bit more frequent now, Maria, that we see people at malls, buses, everywhere with a therapy dog. And sometimes you see a vest on that dog, sometimes you don't. And so some people are wondering a little bit about what does it take to have a therapy dog? Can I just order a vest online and put it on my dog so I can take him somewhere? And apparently that's a no-no.
Right. Okay, so let's just get the nomenclature straight. Therapy dogs are the ones who go and visit people in hospitals and nursing homes, and they're trained to, they're very calm. They have to go through a specific kind of training. So that's that. I was getting the terminology confused as well at first, but we're talking about service dogs and or emotional support animals. They're two different things, and yeah, unfortunately, there is a lot of fakery going on. It is very easy to just say your dog is a service dog. The laws are not strict on this. There are some good reasons for that, but it's really hard. More and more stores are not just saying service dogs, but explaining what service dogs are on their signage, at least in California, that they must be trained to mitigate a disability. And there are not that many things that someone who runs a business can ask for service dogs, but the service dog has to be very well behaved. People are taking advantage of this just to be able to take their dog into stores, into grocery stores, onto airplanes, to get into hotels that wouldn't allow dogs. And it can actually really be harmful to the real service dogs out there and the emotional support animals who are really well trained. And that's bad. I could go online right now and order an emotional support animal vest or a service dog vest for my dog and bring him places. And that's something that probably should be changed. It's not something I really get into in my book. It's a really big, it's a really controversial topic. And I'm not there to figure out how this can be changed, because if the laws come down too much on really getting a lot of training, that could prevent some people from having their service dogs who have gotten good training that is extremely effective and their dogs are really good, but maybe they're so disabled that they can't get out there and show this. So there's a lot of difficulty in trying to figure out a solution to this, but I really hope there will be, because I've talked to service dog owners, legitimate service dog owners whose dogs help them, for instance, with their diabetes, tracking if they're too low or too high. And their service dogs have been rendered just pets, because sometimes a dog will come up to them and attack them in a public situation. And this is really bad. This is a life-saving dog who is not able to work anymore, because someone who says their dog is a service dog has a dog who has launched into one of these dogs. So, it's a big, gooey topic that I hope will be resolved sometime.
In the introduction to your book, Dr. Dogs, the first thing, I mean, right from the very beginning, you're just like, oh, wow, this is interesting, that you got a giant replica of a dog's nose in the mail.
Yeah, it was a life-size replica of a dog's nose. It came from a fluid dynamicist who works for Standards and Training, and he is very interested in dog's noses on the inside and the outside, what makes them so good and so efficient. I did not get a replica of the inside of a dog's nose. That is extremely intricate, but they did model the nose, the inside of a dog's nose and the outside, the one I have, on a dog who was donated for science. And they did MRIs of her nose, and they were able to use this to figure out what it is and how amazingly this dog, when a dog sniffs, what happens, and what happens to the air around it, and how it goes in one nostril, how rapidly they sniff. And if they actually do this, if they put this on the end of the technology that is being used today for chemical analysis, it doesn't have to be the actual nose, but that sort of thing with two sniffers and a sideways sort of inroad to the nose, they find, and the rapid sniffing, five times in a second, they find that it greatly increases the efficiency and the accuracy of these chemical analysis devices. So there's definitely something there. And this nose, I kept this nose on my desk during the writing of the book to inspire me to continue to focus on really what the focus of the book is on, is this cutting edge of what dogs are doing these days. We don't really talk so much about guide dogs or hearing dogs, but more of the recent science that shows that so much of what a dog can do is through the nose. And of course, the bond.
Well, we've always kind of assumed that dogs have a very keen sense of smell. But in your book, you tell us just how much that we have 6 million olfactory receptors in our noses. Dogs can have up to 300 million.
Yeah, and their brains are better equipped to make sense of these scents. Their olfactory world is rich and vivid. It's kind of like our visual world. One researcher I interviewed at the University of Pennsylvania, Cindy Otto, she likes to say that dogs can smell in color. And that just opened my world when she said that, because you can really relate. And anyone who has a dog knows when their dog is sniffing a spot interminably, what that's like. But when you realize what they're sort of seeing, when their whole world is around olfaction, it really makes you stop and think of what they're getting from what they're sniffing.
So in your book, Dr. Dogs, you take us kind of on a around-the-world trip of dogs in different countries, what they do, and give us examples. And even before we get into some of the other chapters that you talk about, from the very beginning, you tell us about Stewie. And if you wouldn't mind sharing with us the Stewie story, and also the fact that you were hoping that Stewie wouldn't come up and sniff you.
Yes. It's probably the first time I ever wanted a dog to ignore me. We have a history of ovarian cancer in our family, and this was, I was starting the research for the book at a time when I had really bad health insurance that I'm supposed to be checked every year with a test with ultrasounds that run about $2,000 or $3,000. I have a big deductible, so I learned about a dog at one place I was going to visit in California who moonlights. She knows how to sniff out various cancers, especially ovarian cancer. She's been trained on a few types of cancers, but she was trained on ovarian, and she does that in sort of a laboratory setting, but her person says that she sort of moonlight sometimes, which is not what her trainer wants her to do, but she will sometimes go up to a person, and the way she alerts in the research setting is she paws at a sample. She just gives her paw as if she's shaking hands, but she keeps doing it. And so she will do this to people sometimes, and this puts her person in a very difficult predicament because she knows that this might mean that she sniffs this scent on the person, or it may not, but it's something that she does not encourage at all, but the dog still does this. So I figured, well, I'm going to go up there and see what's going on here. I'm going to meet Stewie, and I'll just see what happens. And if, God forbid, she paws at me, I will get that $3,000 test. And so I went with trepidation, and Stewie was actually outside when I got there. And she ran up to me and rolled on her back for a belly rub, and then walked away and met my dog. So, whew, I got out of that one, and it bought me a year. I know it's completely unscientific and probably stupid if there was something going on there, but hey, it gave me a little peace of mind anyway.
And at the beginning of the book also, we find out about the doctor, I'm trying to remember his name, Dr. Willis, I believe, Thomas Willis, 1674.
Right. He was, so this is about diabetes, and he was very much into the smell and the taste of diabetes, in a way, of urine. He would dabble in tasting urine or smelling urine. There was a whole urine wheel for sweetness and color, and that's how they could tell. He was the first one to sort of, yeah.
We're visiting with New York Times bestselling author Maria Goodevej. And she is the author of the book, Dr. Dogs, How Our Best Friends Are Becoming Our Best Medicine. As I mentioned earlier, you take us virtually around the world with different countries, different dogs, and different types of diseases that they can sniff out. And it's pretty broad what they can do.
Yes, they're used in various settings. Of course, service dogs. They're partnering with people who I just discussed have diabetes, and they can tell sometimes 15 or 20 minutes before the person's device can tell that they're going into a diabetic low, and the person can stop what they're doing and check out their blood sugar and do something about it at the time. They're also with people who have seizure disorders. It's been found recently that, yes, dogs can detect seizures by scent, and of course, probably by some body language we're not aware of yet. They're being used for diseases that we don't even know a diagnosis for. Sometimes they can be trained to just on the scent of someone before they have a paralysis attack or before they lose consciousness. Doctors may not know why or what's going on, but a dog can tell if trained on that scent just before the person falls or has an attack or whatever, the dog can alert the person so the person can get a life back. They can take a shower. They can take a walk. And they're also working with scientists in research setting. And let's get this out of the way. These are not beagles locked in cages. These are usually dogs who are pet dogs and or foster dogs, and they come in for a day of work or a part day of work. They're looking at Parkinson's. They're trying to do early Parkinson's detection and many kinds of cancer. I have a very long chapter in the book about the various types of cancers dogs are detecting, how they're detecting it, how well, and how in the long run dogs are not going to be testing for cancers in laboratories, or they're not going to be in the back room of your doctor's office saying, oh, yes, this person has cancer. No, this person doesn't. They're leading to new technology. They're working with scientists, actually, with chemical analysis to try to separate out what the smell of cancer is to them, what the volatile organic compounds.
Tell us a little bit about some of these pictures that you have in your book, because you have some incredible pictures as well.
Okay, I'm going to have to open the book for that.
Okay.
Well, yes, on the first page I have my dog Gus, who is covered with poop from, I think it was a coyote and a horse that day, and that was just to show how dogs revel in the sense of smell. And my dog he gets very pumped up when he smells like other animals, and other dogs look at him like he's a rock star. I've got a picture of me with Stewie, the dog we discussed earlier, but also we have the dogs who detect diabetes and dogs who save their people from seizures. This one woman is shown hugging her dog. She can now take showers because her dog warns her. Before, if her husband wasn't right there, she couldn't take a shower because she could collapse and really hurt herself. There are dogs from Croatia who sniff out seizures, dogs from Japan who are cancer. We have dogs going around the cancer wheel, or they're sniffing out. Actually, something else in the book is the way dogs are helping with pathogen detection. And the hope is maybe one day they can help stop an epidemic before it becomes a pandemic. They're able to sniff out MRSAs and various disorders that are usually not even able to be detected in laboratories that easily. They're walking around hospitals sniffing out C. diff, which is a bacteria that's very dangerous to vulnerable populations. There's a picture of a dog here in a gurney with his young man, who is someone who had these paralysis episodes, and the dog saves him every day. So we've got dogs around the world in the pictures, and they're all so cute.
And there are probably a lot of places on the social media that people can go to find out more about your book and your research. Would you mind sharing with us your webpage?
Yeah, it's my name, Maria Godavage, GOODAVAGE.com. It's like Good Savage without the S. And from there, I'll have all my links to my social media up as well. And my other books are on there as well.
Maria, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. That was fun.
We've been visiting with New York Times bestselling author Maria Godavage. Her book is Dr. Dogs, How Our Best Friends Are Becoming Our Best Medicine. The book is out October 1st. Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTEP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Sam Cassiano. We had help from Chris Williams. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.